Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show is episode number 51, featuring my conversation with two original Freedom Writers, Ty Leggins and Shanette Jones. They share their experiences as African-American parents, citizens, and veterans living during the age of Black Lives Matter. After their courageous conversation, we'll hear from Dr. Robert Hill, the Vice President of Student Services at Everett Community College. Dr. Hill shares with us the perspective as an African-American educator and his hope for a bright future ahead for all students, regardless of their race. In these trying times, I hope that these powerful discussions will leave you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. In his famous I Have a Dream speech, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. evoked the Emancipation Proclamation made in 1863 by President Abraham Lincoln. The proclamation declared millions of African-American slaves free, but Dr. King reminded his audience that even 100 years later, African-Americans were still not free. August 28, 2020, marks the 57th anniversary of Dr. King's historic speech from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. Yet sadly, citizens are still dreaming for that better day. This past year has been marked not only by a deadly virus that disproportionately affects communities of color, but also by increased racial tension due to strained relationships between law enforcement and African Americans. When I originally asked Ty and Shanette to come to our office and talk about their personal experience with the Black Lives Matter movement, I had no clue that we would lose our namesake, former freedom writer, Congressman John Lewis. In the wake of his passing, we spoke about his lasting impact and how the freedom writers have gotten into good trouble in his honor. However, Ty and Shanette also share the dark reality of what it is like to be an African American in today's troubling world. Fears for their own safety and the safety of their children make up the thoughts that haunt and jar their security. The sad reality is that Dr. King's dream is still that, a dream, one that courageous demonstrators and activists alike work to realize each and every day. Through movements like Black Lives Matter, they are making peaceful progress towards turning Dr. King's dream into a reality. But until that day, sadly, we are far from equal. Without further ado, here is my conversation with original Freedom Writers, Ty Leggins and Shanette Jones. In the wake of John Lewis, the boy from Troy who became a congressman in Atlanta, Georgia, former President Obama said he loved this country so much that he risked his life and his blood so that it might live up to its promise. And my two guests today did just that. They love this country so much that they too risk their lives and their blood so that it might live up to its promise. So it's an honor for me to introduce two freedom writers who have served and sacrificed on the battlefield, in the classroom, and in this country. Welcome, Shanette and Ty. When you hear that rousing ode that President Obama paid to the freedom writer John Lewis, our namesake, I think President Obama could say the same thing for both of you because you did serve and sacrifice. So let's start there. What does that mean when you serve and when you sacrifice for the promise of what should be, which is not always the promise that is?
I'd say it's almost like paying it forward, knowing as a service member that we are not really fighting for ourselves, but the collective American experience. We know that we put ourselves in harm's way for that purpose, that nothing in life is truly free, and we pay that price. Many of us are put in harm's way, and we do it willingly, knowing that if you are safe at home, then so be it. Then I'll be the one to take that step and take the brunt of whatever storm is raging in our direction.
I think it's a selfless act for everyone. That includes our family, too. So our loved ones, we guarantee their comfort to be able to sleep at night while we take the brunt of the storm.
As freedom writers, we studied John Lewis walking over the Edmund Pettus Bridge for the simple right to vote. He paid a price with his own blood. And so when you had the opportunity to learn about Congressman John Lewis and then meet him, what was that like knowing that he shed blood for us to vote, for us to have that promise of equality that we've yet to find?
It makes him a service member as well. His steps that he took were for someone else, like the steps we take. I mean, we've come a long way since he took his first steps, and we'll be even further when our kids learn what steps we have taken for them.
Nicole Hannah-Jones of the New York Times Magazine wrote an exquisite article about racism in our country. And I love this quote. She said, "The changes we're seeing today in some ways seem shockingly swift and in other ways, rage-inducingly slow." So this podcast is going to be looking at racism and looking at what we say now is Black Lives Matter. So starting with that, Ty, tell me as an African-American man why it is so important for people to understand the term Black Lives Matter.
The significance of saying that Black Lives Matter is not simply to elevate our voice or our lives above the lives of others. We're simply saying, acknowledge the fact that we're here, that we matter, and to hear the counter narrative of all lives matter as a response to that. I feel that all lives truly cannot matter until Black Lives Matter. All of this stuff has always been happening, but the fact that people have so many cameras and that it's all connected to social media, America's face to actually see its dirty secrets. We can't look the other way and say that, oh, that's a thing of the past, because we've never really moved forward. Now everybody has the chance to see that this is our struggle and that it's a collective struggle. It's not just simply about races. There's only one race, and that's the human race. Until we can all see each other as equal, all lives will never matter.
Often we hear that if true justice and true equality are ever to be achieved in our lifetime and achieved in America, that collectively we have to seriously look back at what America owes to Black Americans. So, Shanette, do you feel that you sufficiently learned enough about the plight of slavery and everything that was, as Ty just referenced, these dirty little secrets?
Not at all. Primarily because our history has been erased. And now that people are trying to figure out why Black lives should matter, they're actually digging in the trenches to find what our history was that has been masked and covered up this entire time.
They often say that history books are written by those who win the war, and you are soldiers. So this is a different kind of a war of equality. So what I want you to imagine is a young person learning history from you. So when you think about your ancestors, when you think about slavery, what would you want a young person to understand about the inequities, the dehumanization of the human spirit, the human body during those times of slavery?
Before you answer that, I think it's very important that this be said first. For any young African American, male or female, listening to this podcast, know that your history does not start with slavery. We are from the cradle of civilization, Africa, and there were kings and queens. There's a whole dynasty, a 25th dynasty in Egypt, were ran by Black leaders, Black pharaohs, and they don't talk about that. So know that your history does not start with you being shackled on a ship, taken from your homeland, stripped of your religion, stripped of your birth name, your birthright, your culture, stripped of all of that. And that needs to be taught.
Shanette, take us back to the proud lineage of your ancestors.
It's not my ancestors, it's everyone's. Because everyone started in Africa. Now, where they went from there determined where people claim they are from now. Whether you went far south as the equator or far north as the mountains of Caucasus. So it's up to us to dig deep in that rich African soil and leave the heaviest footprint we can possibly do.
When we look at the prosperity and the wealth of this country, it really is inexplicably linked to forced labor, to trafficking of the human spirit. And the ancestors now of 40 million Black Americans, many of whom have those roots tied to that horrific part of our history that was stripped of the knowledge you just said, of this humble, noble beginning on the continent of Africa. How does that make you feel now?
Well, it makes me feel like I'm walking around with a question mark above my head because I don't know my lineage from Africa. But even here, you still don't have anything. Because when you try to accomplish something, you're only trying to still push the door open. And in pushing that door open, all your energy goes to keeping it open because it doesn't stay open for the next. So that's the problem with it being here. We will forever, at that rate, stay a slave.
I love the best-selling author, Ta-Nehisi Coates. And a quote that really stuck out to me was, "Racism is the child of economic profiteering."
Anything other than me, I'm going to pick on or force the ones that I consider other than me to do the work that I will no longer do, or I see myself higher, more superior to do. So now you're my bought slave. So now I can tell you what to do because I control how you eat, when you eat, where you live, how you choose to live, and how far that glass ceiling goes for you.
I think what a lot of people did not learn in schools, myself included, was after the Civil War and after slavery ended, I'm going to use some air quotes that our listeners can't see, that the 100-year period of racial apartheid and racial terrorism that a lot of us know as the Jim Crow laws, the Jim Crow South, created this horrific system of economic exploitation, poll taxes for voting. There was redlining for purchasing of homes. So can you talk about what you think racial apartheid and racial terrorism meant to some of our ancestors in this country after they were given freedom?
Honestly, it's like a big slap in the face. To be taken from your homeland, to be brutalized, have your family separated, have the men sent to what they call buck farms, where they would actually rape the men and they would have families there to watch like it was a picnic. To go through something like that, and then to be freed just to have a police force formed afterwards to go and retrieve those slaves that were freed or those that would run away to want to be free. I mean, that system is still prevalent today. I mean, it leads into police brutality. I mean, it's a whole complete system. If you look at where there's any heavy concentration of African Americans, you'll see an area that's depleted of, you know, good schools. You know, it's always predatory lending. You see a fast food place, you see strip clubs, you see liquor stores, things that you won't see in a well-off neighborhood. So even though we got free, they put us back in this situation where you're still fighting for that freedom, that it's never truly equal. It's separate but equal, but never really equal. Although many white Americans aren't the reason why we went through what we went through, they are benefiting from what we went through. So the fact that you still benefit from that, because wealth is passed down. We weren't able to hold property and be able to build our wealth, you know, generational wealth that we can pass on to our kids. We're gonna constantly be in a situation where that economic gap is gonna be growing, increasing and increasing. So the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, and we're still looking for handouts. Being told to, hey, forget about what happened to you, it's the past, just get over it. You know, but 9/11, always remember. You know, Holocaust, never forget that. But when we talk about the Holocaust that African Americans went through, we're not allowed to talk about that. They kind of changed the narrative in regards to the Black president too. So when we heard him say, we can make a change, we can make a positive change, we believe that. Now the president, yes, he was the figurehead for our country, but Congress writes the laws, Senate enacts on it. They have to vote it in. So everything that he wanted to do to uplift our community, Senate said, no, we're not doing it. So every time we're trying to get a leg up, not even to get above the status quo, we just want to be treated as equals.
Ty said a really interesting comment about, lest we forget, never forget 9/11, Holocaust. Do you remember as a child, the first time you learned, either from a parent or an ancestor or even a teacher, about slavery? What was that like, to the very first time you were exposed to this horrific past?
The first time I was exposed to it, of course, was in school, but it wasn't taught to me that that was my past. It was given as if it was like just something of the past. We really don't know who these people are, but they're on a boat. They're shackled. And it was a long journey. Okay. And to me, it's like, this is boring because I had no connection to it. But I think that that was their goal, is to desensitize exactly what had happened.
So unlike everything we did in room 203 was that it's got to be real. It's got to be relevant. We have to have a relationship to it. So as a mother with three beautiful sons who went through an education in room 203 where things are real and relevant, how could you enlighten your sons who ask you, Mom, what does this mean? What does slavery mean? What would you tell your sons?
I tell them now, you have to read before that book was written and after it was published, because history changes, but it's always someone's perception. So you have to find your own. And when you find your own, you find your foundation.
So I want to talk to you guys about when you made the decision that you were going to serve with dignity and honor. My brother also, with dignity and honor, decided to serve. My brother was sent across the country to Fort Hood. I had no idea that Fort Hood was named after a Confederate soldier. So let's talk about what it's like knowing that you served our country, that there are these bases that were named after Confederate soldiers who were essentially traitors to the United States of America.
Yeah, it's off-putting. The fact that is based off of hate and people who betrayed our country. I mean, there's treasonous. When I was stationed in North Carolina, I was with a unit called 2nd Amphibious Assault Battalion. We were in the back of the base. They called it Courthouse Bay. So back there with us was engineer school. So our motor T department for motor transport, all of them were considered the rebels. They had to pick up trucks with the rebel flags. And every time we would go to the field, there would be situations where I had to go make my rounds as their hospital corpsman, make sure all my Marines were taken care of. Sometimes I'd get a call on the radio. They'd say, N-bomb, gun one. That lets me know what position to go to and that somebody made a racial comment. So I had to go figure out what was going on. And there was one situation I walked in on and they said, N-bomb on gun one. I went to that location. I had a corporal yelling at a private, calling him a nigger to his face. I stepped in to protect him, and then I got in trouble when I got back. My senior corpsman said, hey, Chief wants to talk to me to get in. He heard what you did out there, and you know you're in trouble, right? I don't see what the big deal is. I tell my friends all the time they're tracking like a bunch of stupid niggers. This was a white guy saying this to me. And I'm just like, what in the world? And he was like, well, what, you got a problem with what I said? Yeah, I do. Now, my company, Gunny, is a black man. He felt the same way. So being in a command where there was not a lot of African Americans and then having African Americans in leadership who believed the same way those rebel boys did, it was kind of hard to actually do my job there, to actually know that I got to look past the hate and I got to look at you as a Marine. I got to take care of you. Although you would hate me, spit on me, call me a nigger to my face, but I still got to treat you like I love you because you're a brother in arms. It is so hard to deal with that. And to go into combat knowing that these people feel this way, you got to be able to trust the man to your left and your right. And if you know deep down in his heart that he hates you just because of your skin color, it kind of makes it harder to do that job. Really hard.
When you were at that base, Ty, did you know then what America's learning now, that these bases were named after Confederate soldiers?
I had no idea that Camp Lejeune itself was named after one of those as well. Nobody tells you that stuff. You just know that that's the base you're going to, but they don't give you the rundown of the base's history. You just know it's been around for a while. You're there for training, or that's your duty station. They never really go into the details about that as a base as a whole. Now, when you're in a unit, you may learn your unit history, you know, especially if they have battle flags, if they've been to combat, they'll explain that. But as far as the overall knowledge of the name of that general, what he was, what he stood for, we're not taught that. Like, if we knew that these were named after people who struck out against our country, what? That doesn't even make sense to me. I can't even fathom that. How can we be a symbol of democracy, a symbol of justice throughout the world, yet our bases are named after hate? It just doesn't make sense to me.
Let's talk about hate, because as noble freedom riders, just like John Lewis, believed in the pursuit of justice across the globe. So in California, you don't generally see as many of these images. We don't have the monuments, the bases here, or the flags. But let's talk about the Dixie flag. What was it like the first time you saw a Dixie flag?
First time I saw a Dixie flag, I had no connection to what it actually represented because I was a young kid watching Dukes of Hazzard. I saw it on the General Lee vehicle. It was on the hood of the car. So I'm thinking they were, excuse my language, they were a bunch of badasses. So I'm thinking, hey, that's cool. I did not know what that represented at that age. It was on TV. Nobody was talking about it. It was just, hey, the boys of Dukes of Hazzard, the Hazzard County, just in some more trouble again. Let's see how to get out of this time. That's all we knew. But then to learn eventually that that was a symbol of hate, it made me feel, I don't know, I felt jaded because I was watching this show and I'm just like, if this country is supposed to be the symbol of love and democracy throughout the world, why is this on the TV? Why is this not being talked about? Why is this loved? Why are people so happy to fly the flag of treason? It's not even the flag of our nation. You can't even fly the swastika in Germany, yet that is flying here crazy like it's the American flag. I don't get it.
Both of you are parents of beautiful boys. And I want to take us backwards to three women who, like so many of us, were horrified that a teenage boy simply walking home with a bag of Skittles lost his life. And in 2013, these three women, Patrice Konkulis, Alicia Garza, and Opal Tometi, decided to create Black Lives Matter. In 2013, it is 7 years later that it is getting traction. But as a mother and as a father, knowing that this beautiful young boy lost his life, what take us backwards so that we can go forward.
That was terrifying. It still is because nothing's changed. I still don't want my sons walking anywhere because I want to at least try my damnedest to control whether they come back. It's suffocating. And that's just the minutes of the day that you know your son is okay. But you don't know if he won't be okay later. So it's literally minute by minute because you don't know who he may encounter. And now that I have a child in a whole other state, it's even harder.
So for our audience, what Jeanette is referring to is her oldest son, Tyler, who's incredible, got a scholarship from the Freedom Riders Foundation, started his freshman year at college, moved away from home like so many kids in America do to start this new life of being a scholar. You're so proud of his accomplishment scholastically, but you're also terrified because he's not under your watch.
Yes, especially now, because with the Black Lives Matter movement, it's a lot more protests. But of course, you get the counter protests as well. And for him, he has to go right down the middle of both to get to work. And now he has glares. He has the stares. And now when they come into the grocery store, they look at him like, I know where you live because I saw where you came from. So that was the first time I got the text of, Mom, I don't feel safe. And it's like, what do I do? I can't say go to the police because right now people are fearing the police. So the only thing I could tell him is give it to God. Because if it's your time, I have to let go. And if it's not, you'll come back. There's nothing I can give my son to soothe him. I gotta give him life. And he has to make impressions to change for the future.
Ty, you also have a beautiful boy who just graduated from high school, who is going to go out in the world, in a world that we have increased militarization, in a world that we have increased law enforcement spending, in a world that has mass incarceration disproportionately to young men of color, in a world that these teenage boys are afraid of those in blue to serve and sacrifice. So as a father to a beautiful, brilliant young boy, what are your fears? Do they reflect Shanette's fears?
They definitely do. I mean, every African-American parent is fearful of getting that call or that text or seeing it go live of your child being murdered by police. And the fact that Black Lives Matter is getting so much traction, with the amount of positive traction, you got a lot of negative traction that's coming as well, and people are getting more emboldened. I mean, every time they always try to change the narrative, you know, it's something that George Soros is funding, it's anti-Semitic, it's this, it's that. They try to tear it down so much that they almost try to make you feel ashamed for even wanting to say that Black Lives Matter. Had this conversation recently with my son. He said that he keeps hearing, because he's, you know, supporting BLM, he's heard from a lot of patrons, you know, why are you doing that out here? You know, we don't have any Breonna Taylors here. There's no kids being killed by cops. You're just wasting your time. BLM shouldn't even be a thing out here. This is what they're telling them. It's hard being a Black parent in white America when you're trying to make sure your kids survive. When you have to have that conversation of how to interact with cops just so you don't get shot, even knowing that when you're complying, saying following all those instructions, hands raised, you're not making any sudden movements, but you still get shot for it. It's that we're never going to be the victims in that situation. We're always going to be the attacker. And I've experienced that on so many levels, and trying to be a parent, trying to navigate those waters is hard, because you don't know if your kids are going to make it home. Hell, you don't even know if you're going to make it home. Every day is a fight. And I'm glad that there's more traction, but it's dangerous too. It's becoming more dangerous. And I understand it's dangerous now, but I'm fearful that it's going to get worse. Yes, Black Lives Matters. You know, America as a whole is still not ready to accept that Black Lives Matters, because if it did, there wouldn't be such inequality. The education wouldn't be the way it is. Why are historical content of people who are of African descent only an elective, but we're force-fed European history the whole time through school? When I was growing up, I didn't even know where I came from. Africa's not really talked about that much. And, you know, you get Black History Month, so we get 1 month out of the year. Whoop-de-doo. And it's the same people we talk about. We always talk about, you know, Rosa Parks, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, but we don't know anything further than that. We don't know about the Black Panthers, how they started WIC, something that people are still using today. The fact that they were created to uplift the community, not to be the new KKK, the Black version. It was to protect the communities, because we knew that the police wasn't going to protect us. You know, the fact that we know that there's going to be inequality. So we were like, oh, hey, Black Wall Street, we're going to build our own. You don't want to lend to us, we're going to create our own. What did they do? They got mad and blew all that up. But we are not taught any of that stuff. All this stuff is missing from history. So the fact that we have teens, we have young African Americans who are going to be going out into the world to make their statement and live their truth and have their kids come to this world. The things that we teach them, and the fact that the nation is starting to change in regards to this, is something positive. But on the other end, we still got people being killed. How long has it been since Breonna Taylor was murdered? Cops are still not arrested. The DA's talking about, we want enough time to get a full investigation. So if there's any exonerations, we want to make sure that, you know, that gets heard too. Like, how long are these people going to be on the job still getting paid? Like, how can you say Black Lives Matters when it's okay to kill us and you still get paid?
So as parents, when you think about this concept of a country that is built on the precept that you are innocent until proven guilty, except if you are walking home from a convenience store with Skittles in your hand, unless you are a young boy playing with a toy gun in a park, unless you are a young woman sleeping in your own home. Think about all of those cases of innocence, but they were guilty, and there was an executioner. What does that do to you?
It makes you wonder what other part of life is going to be your end, because those are all natural things you do, and they have become the very thing that has taken their life. What am I going to do in my day-to-day that is going to cause someone so much fear that they may do as well, but it takes my life? Once again, there's no answer.
John Lewis is quoted as saying, "If not us, then who? If not now, then when?" A question that John Lewis has asked for generations. And suddenly, in 2020, in the midst of a pandemic, after 8 minutes and 46 seconds that we watched the very last breath of George Floyd, people began to protest and march and demand recognition of humanity, recognition of citizenship. So for you, having learned from John Lewis and watching what has unfolded, tell me what it feels like to watch protests, not just in America, but it's rippling across the globe. What does it feel like to watch that? If not us, then who? People are saying us and now, not them, not when.
It's refreshing because it shows that someone's listening, and someone that even doesn't look like you is willing to fight with you hand in hand, which goes back to John Lewis, "Across That Bridge." Everyone didn't look the same, but they knew deep down that the fight was needed, and someone had to do it. So in this case, we are the now, and we must do it. So no one else is going to do it. The when is now.
I think collectively as a nation, the blinders are off. You can no longer act like these things don't exist. Although it didn't happen the way we wanted it to, it's good that the conversation's happening and that we're moving forward.
What we have seen in this country are tides of change. In certain communities, they've moved, lawmakers are now banned from chokeholds. In certain communities, they are considering stripping the immunity for officers who kill. In certain communities, they're moving budgets from the police to social services. In your community, there was a young African-American man hanging from a tree. To anyone, it looks like a modern-day lynching. A city square that you pass by every day on the way to the grocery store for your young boys. So tell me what that was like, knowing that we're making these great strides to try to change. And where you live, there was a modern day lynching.
It brought history to life, because for me, that could have been one of my boys. It leads us to the fact that there's still someone out there willing to do this, and they have the power to do it. Common word you said was community, not Capitol Hill. So the communities are saying this is what we need, but we need more communities to band together. We need to figure out something that is going to shock them so we get the awe.
When you've seen this string of young men across our country hanging from trees, and they're describing it as a suicide. Tell me what your feeling is, knowing your history, seeing those images of the past, and then realizing that they're images of our present.
It's hard to answer that without feeling the pain that comes with that. I'll just start by saying this. Black people don't commit suicide by lynching themselves. I mean, that's the equivocation of me putting a burning cross in my own front yard. We just don't do that. And the fact that they want to rule all of these as suicides is just another way to put a Band-Aid on it, to say, shut up, you know, to kick that can down the road. When there is so much visibility on what's going on right now, we still have law enforcement and those that are, you know, in charge, you know, those that we elected, they're still trying to silence this, to try to quiet it down. What we got to do is look deeper at all the issues that are going into this. I mean, there are so many communities filled with hate, and there's pockets of them. And we really don't know until stuff like this happens. You think you're safe until you see an African-American hanging from a tree. And to have 4 African-Americans hung by a tree and 1 Latino, and all of those be listed as a suicide with no deep investigations. I mean, how is this okay with America? How is something that was used as a way to torture and torment us through the Jim Crow era, how is that okay? How are we just supposed to look past that? Oh, it's okay. They said suicide. Like, where's the accountability? This kind of leads into the defunding the police. Like, the narrative behind that, people kind of get lost in understanding what that really means. We're not saying we want to take all your funding away. We're saying there's no reason for you to have up-armored vehicles like you're going into a war zone. How are you supposed to make your community feel safe if you are coming at them like they're enemy combatants? And you don't even live in a neighborhood that you're policing. That's the other thing that's the issue. So defunding the police is not stripping all of their funding. It's to reallocate those funds to go to uplifting the communities. If you uplift the community, I bet you, I guarantee you, there will be a lower crime rate. If you invest in their schools, there'll be more kids, more educated, who have goals that they're actually going to act on, instead of thinking that the only way out of the hood is by basketball or rapping. Education is the greatest equalizer. Put the funding where it needs to be. Uplift the communities. And once you do that, the policing, it will take care of itself. When you look at where the majority of the concentration of any minority community is, you can see that there is great inequality. It's not just the social inequalities, the social injustices. There's a bigger system. We have to change everything as a whole, make everything truly equal so we can really say that we're a nation.
In 2019, John Lewis was worried that we were going backwards. And John Lewis said, there are forces in America today trying to take us back to another time, another period. We came too far and made too much progress to go back. For you, Jeanette, what does it mean to go forward in a country that's still trying to take us backward?
For me, it's showing the equality is there. It's accessible to all. Because in lieu of John Lewis, when he got that National Book Award, he cried. Because he can remember when he couldn't even have a library card. So if you can't read it, you can't understand. And the one thing we all know is they hid stuff from us in a book because we were not allowed to read. So to make sure that everything is equal and accessible across the board, no strings attached, no strings, and let us grow, let us prosper.
Thank you, Ty and Jeanette, for sharing your experiences and continuing to fight against bigotry and racism. The strength that both of these Freedom Riders show is a testament to the virtue and honor they both exude. To conclude this episode, I wanted to highlight Dr. Robert Hill's unique perspective on the Black Lives Matter movement as an esteemed African-American educator. Dr. Hill has been an integral part of our Freedom Rider family since 1997. He joined us on our trip to visit concentration camps in Europe, helped Freedom Riders transition from high school to community college, then became a Freedom Rider teacher. Most recently, he reviewed Freedom Rider Dr.
Jessica Martinez's doctoral dissertation. The Friedemars and I have always seen education as the greatest equalizer. And as an educator, Dr. Hill continues to make it more inclusive and more equitable. Here is Dr. Hill. Dr. Hill, I love the expression that education can equalize an unfair playing field. But is it safe to assume that education has not always been equal?
Yes, I think it's safe to assume that it has not been equal. I think we've had great efforts along the way to try to make it equal and usher in the new word equity and equitize the process. But as long as we have zip codes that are not quite at the same level as other zip codes, we're always going to have inequitable outcomes and inequitable opportunities. The reality is certain people live in certain parts of the public sector and the city or urban environment. Very rarely do poor folks live in the suburbs. So as long as you have that, you're going to have inequitable, you know, educational opportunities.
For our listeners who don't live in America, America's really scrambling with history. Oftentimes, we don't tell the full story. So can you tell some of our listeners about the lack of educational opportunities for people in our country going back before we had democracy, before we had a constitution, how education truly kept people apart?
In terms of the colonized America, long before we had the revolution and were independent from England, the Americas were colonized. And 1619 is the article. And that basically chronicles the arrival of the African in the Americas and slavery. And as such, to keep that enslavement mentality, education was not, just learning was not something that was tolerated, even though there was laws and some brutal methods to continue to have the African uneducated. And I think when you go through that initiation in this country, then you can talk about that's the start of a certain level of oppression on purpose, and anything subsequently is trying to get away from that initiation or that introduction of the African into the Americas.
I went to public schools. I taught at public schools, but I don't think my textbooks then really explained that we deliberately kept education away, that we deliberately enslaved people. So for you, when you learned that, did you learn it in elementary school, middle school, or high school? Or did you learn that when you became a professor and you had to seek those answers?
Well, ironically, I went to all white schools because my mother was an educator. And because she was the first black educator in Orange County, there was a lot of problems with us going to the same school district. There was a lot of harassment. There's a lot of different things going on politically. And so she wanted us to get the best education. So she sent us to private schools. Now, that said, because of that, our mother was basically, one of her first jobs was a black cultural specialist. And so we learned our black history, the beginning since I could read, about three to 4 years old. However, I wouldn't say it was the happiest moment in the world, because how does a four-year-old or three-year-old process, you know, slavery and all those things that go along with it? And, you know, why would you have to learn about Nat Turner, who was revolting against enslavement, or you know, Harry Tubman, or all these people that we learned about, and you weren't proud of them, you know, because you were trying to fit into a white school, you know, you're trying to listen to white music and have friends, and those friends at those white schools, they were pretty mean. And so if you talked about anything and try to have an affinity to your cultural identity, that was not, you know, that's not something in Newport Beach that you wanted to associate yourself with. You just want to stimulate. Basically, you're young. You want to have friends. So it was not till I was older than I was starting to embrace it, and that I actually had a certain level of pride of it, you know, in it. And, you know, I would always go to events with my mother, and she'd be announced as the first black teacher of this. And, you know, she was very proud of her heritage. So there was an interesting balance between social identity and also my educational and academic identity. It's almost very bifurcated. You're one way in your community, and you're another way to fit into your academic institution. And it really happened along most of my educational journey. It was very rare that I would have somebody that was of my heritage or that would speak to my heritage. So it was a long time before you actually start to embrace that pride and, you know, in your culture.
I think for a lot of people who've seen the Freedom Riders movie, one of the really stirring elements is when the character in the movie named Victoria, you know her as Tanya, actually confronted a teacher who was racist and overtly so, and tried to make her feel that she was taking a Gallup poll, and the word token was used. Can you describe what that's like when you are an African-American student in a predominantly Caucasian class, what that does to you as the student and how you and others often are treated and how that's just such a disservice?
I hate Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer just because of the N-word. I hated that. I was the only black kid in the class, and every time they get to the N-word in that story, everybody turns around and looks at you. So I totally identify with what Tanya went through, and then you're supposed to be the expert on black America. You know, when we're reading Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer, you're like in second grade, third grade, I don't know, whatever. You know, you're not ready to be an authority on black experiences. And not to mention, you're just trying to avoid trying to get in the fight. So when a teacher, a person of authority, actually puts you in that situation to educate the rest of your peers, that is just an unenviable burden that many of us have to do. And it depends on what type of mood you're in that day or, you know, how you're going to handle that. You always try to be gracious. 9 out of 10 times, you're going to try to be gracious. And if I think about all the times that I've had that as an example, and that includes the military too, you know, as you're the teacher of all of black America, assuming that we're all alike, which that's not the case, you try to be as gracious as you possibly can because, you know, that experience with you can dictate how they treat other black people. And so you have a burden, and it's not even a burden, maybe. If you can handle it positively 9 out of 10 times, it's not a burden, it's a responsibility. And so it just depends on how you look at it, you know.
When you learned about Brown versus Board of Education and this civil rights case in education that separate is never equal, what were your feelings when you learned about it in theory, and what were your thoughts about it in practice?
Well, I knew about Thurgood Marshall, right? Thurgood Marshall, based upon what I was taught, he's like a superhero. So it's fun. It was like Superman. You know, I can wear my Superman. I can think about Superman, Marvel Comics, you know, Black Panther and all that stuff now, right? But as a little kid, you watch, you know, cartoons and all these different things. Well, my mother was so fantastic at bringing out, you know, making learning fun. And being creative and, you know, making things that nobody else would make very similar. That's what reminds me of you. And so she would make, you know, Thurgood Marshall this fantastic character. And then she would teach me about Ruby Bridges. You know, I remember this when I was a little boy, you know, and then they teach me about, you know, Thurgood Marshall. He was a superhero because he was the first black Supreme Court justice. And then that's when I started getting excited about laws and you know, different things. And then she taught me about Board versus Education. Now, I didn't know anything about that except that it allowed for us to go to school with other white kids. That's all. And you know, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 years old, whatever it was. And it wasn't until I wouldn't even say in undergrad. I would say probably with my doctorate when I really started looking at the policy from a theoretical framework. And that's when I started looking at it a completely different lens. Probably prior than that, you know, prior to when I was working at Long Beach City College and then talking to you and then the impact of Brown versus Board of Education. I mean, as long as I've known you for over 20 years, that has been a core or a central theme within some of your teachings and some of your things that you're doing. It's a theme that has to come out because even 20 plus years later, it's still something that we have to grapple with. And so I've seen it on folklore's superhero perspective, then coming full circle, or the arc of moral, the arc of the universe, and justice leans towards that way. You can see it from a theoretical framework, and that policy is so tantamount to informing what we're doing today. So I think it's critical.
What I love about you, you've traveled the world, you've served and you've sacrificed, and as an educator, you have seen the world. And
Knowing what we know about apartheid in South Africa, I've often heard the saying and seen it firsthand that in certain states, in certain cities, we have what we could consider educational apartheid. So can you talk about, because you are in the education business, what would educational apartheid be in America?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's separate but equal still, right? We've got de facto segregation because there's so many variables. Oh my gosh, I was watching this documentary and it was talking about the Southern Plan and the voting of the Southern Plan and how that is a strategic form of gerrymandering and you know, redlining districts. And all that translates into where people are going to live. And think about where, you know, okay, if we're going to talk about specifically, and I don't mean to say this in a bad way, when we talk about POC by POC, the Black experience gets lost in that shuffle a little bit because you have to be very succinct about the specific plight of Black Americans in you know, the United States. You have to be specific about Native Americans when you're talking about, you can't just lump them into the yes, they're part of the folks of color, but you have to speak to the experience. And so when you talk about the introduction, I always say the introduction and arrival of Africans in the Americas, when you talk about that introduction, you can't discount the fact of what has been the migration. So when you see clusters of Black folks, there's a reason why they're living there. I just saw the documentary about Pittsburgh, which my family's from, okay? Because there's a steel mill there. You know, there's steel industry in the 50s. You could use your hands, you can use your body, not necessarily your mind, to make a middle class or working class living, okay? Unfortunately, a lot of folks, when that dries up, they're not able to get out, okay? Now, think about that when the businesses leave and the people are left there because they can't get out. What kind of public education system are they going to have, okay? Are they going to have the same education system they have in Irvine, Irvine, California? Probably not. You know, if we did a study of all the zip codes that were predominantly Black folks reside, how many schools would be, you know, blue ribbon schools? And people say, well, how come you don't move? Well, do we want to talk about banking? Do we want to talk about the health index? Do we want to talk about all these things are intersectional? We have to look, and I think we're just starting to do this, look at the factors that preclude specifically Black folks from living in certain places, for attending institutions of higher education or K-12 systems that are going to move generations from inherent poverty into working class, into middle class, and then maybe to upper middle class. And I throw myself in that mix. You know, I've graduated, got a doctorate and all that stuff, but all the folks that have graduated and all these people that have positions, and we have to be careful with saying we have Black faces in high spaces. But if you are of Black heritage in a space, more than likely you probably have to assimilate to a white standard. Okay. And so you really don't get to bring out your Black heritage and your Black culture, because if you do, you're pushing too hard against the establishment. That is the gap between maybe the Civil Rights generation and the Black Lives Matter generation. I call it the Civil Rights generation and the hip hop generation. Because there's a gap in there because we have been placed because we want that color to be represented in education in general. The reality is they just want your face. They don't want your mouth, you know, and that's been a difficult journey for me. And so until we are able to truly address authenticity and agency, when you bring these Black faces or you bring the Native American voice or whoever it is, the LGBTQ voice, if you don't give them agency and purpose to allow them to be at the table, an equal opinion and values and so forth at the table, then we're not going to make those changes.
What is hope in action and what is change in action to you?
It's the realization that you have a stance on one side and somebody has a diametric stance on the opposition. And because something brings you together and it forces you to at least look at the other side, other opinion. If I am not able to look back in my life and say, I could have changed or I learned from the mistakes that I've made. That's hope in action. I think that's change. That's evolution. The person that's the same person at 20 and even worse, maybe at 50, that's not change. The same thing for our country. If we're not better than the day we beat the shit out of John Lewis on that Pettus Bridge, then we don't have hope. How do you carve out hope? You carve out hope by sitting down with you and you think about the best parts of education, knowing that that evolution, that journey, to see the evolution of all of the Freedom Rider teachers, Jessica sitting on her committee, you know, going through her doctorate program. I think when we stop talking over and across and through each other and just really accept each other as we are, you will see that we probably worry about similar things. We will get out of this situation. When we do, we're going to be much better for it. And I'm going to say something, and this is always something I'll leave with. The Colonel told me this. He said, Robert, the best gift you could ever give me, I want people to learn to love each other just a little bit more. Just love each other a little bit more. And I've got an F on that. I think, you know, when I get angry and hope sometimes leaves my body, I sometimes have to bring myself back to that. That's my default. You know, I'm human. I fall down. I get up. You know, I brush myself off and I try to get back to that core belief. Just love each other a little bit more.
I'm so grateful to our guest, Ty Chanette and Dr. Robert Hill, for their strength and their conviction during these trying times. My dear listeners, to invoke the wisdom of our guest and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., may each of us sit down together at the table of brotherhood. May we work together to transform our world into an oasis of freedom and justice. And may we all dream of a day where we are not judged by the color of our skin, but the content of our character. That concludes our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. Once again, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell. This episode was produced and edited by Matt Martin Hall and Rob Falk, with production assistance by Brendan Falk. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.